Welcome to the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My guest this week is Heidi Campbell. Now, Heidi is Professor of Communications at Texas A&M University. She's been there for the last 15 years. Originally from Michigan, Heidi trained as a journalist and then morphed into a religious studies scholar. And we find out about the pioneering interdisciplinary work that she does in media, religion, and culture. Now, Heidi has just edited an online collection, this is really impressive, on the coronavirus pandemic, Religion in Quarantine, the Future of Religion in a Post-Pandemic World. And Heidi talks about churches, which are streaming services, and asks how people are adapting their use of technology. We learn about the rationale for her project, the findings that she has come across, including whether religion needs to be embodied or disembodied, and the relationship between events and communities. During the pandemic, what does it mean for a Muslim, for example, who can't practice their religion in a physical mosque? Heidi reflects on her career. She talks about the role of classical music when she was growing up and focuses on the time when the Space Shuttle Challenger blew up and how it was a traumatic experience to watch live on television. She also talks about the role that 24-hour news had on her mother, how this in turn influenced Heidi's own understanding of media consumption. Heidi talks about the different ways that news is presented in America and the UK in a post-truth era, and concomitant questions around who owns the news media, how it is agenda-driven with multiple stories competing for attention. And she reflects on how this is different from when she was a journalism student, where the role of interpretation wasn't countenanced. Then towards the end of the interview, we learn why Heidi's memories are mainly positive. We find out that she is back in touch with many high school friends via Facebook. She discusses the different political sensibilities that she has experienced and the culture shock that she experienced when she moved to Texas from Edinburgh. She reflects on the cosmopolitanism of living in Edinburgh and how her students today have never heard of Robbie Williams, and she reveals why she had to let go of the Matrix trilogy in her teaching. So join me, Chris Deasy, for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My guest this week, via Zoom, in Texas, during a hailstorm, is Professor Heidi Campbell. So it is absolutely amazing to have my second Zoom interviewee and my first American interview. So it's wonderful to catch up with Heidi Campbell. Hi, Heidi.
Hi, nice to be here. Yeah.
And of course, you're in Texas.
Yes, right in the middle of a thunderstorm right now.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it'll provide a very atmospheric set of acoustics, I think, to our interview. What a great backdrop. And I think when I think of you, I know you're the A&M University. And is that the George Bush Library?
Yes, that's where George Bush has his presidential library. So we're kind of, if you think of Austin and Houston, which are two big towns, if you draw a line between the two, we're kind of smack in the middle.
Yeah, so that's great. And you've been there probably about a decade or more, actually. Is it 15 years you've been there?
15 years. Yeah. It's one of those things I thought, oh, I'll be here just a few years and maybe go back to the UK. And now, you know, I've been promoted just recently to full professor, and I'm part of the furniture.
Wow, congratulations, because 15 years is exactly the amount of time that I've been working at Kent, and I've been at Kent since 2004. And, of course, our careers have kind of dovetailed, because we haven't seen each other in person for about a decade, but, of course, we have links via Edinburgh and various research projects, and, obviously, I've worked quite closely with Jolyon Mitchell, who was your supervisor.
Yeah, and it's also great that, you know, even though we don't see each other for a long time, that, you know, we can keep up with what's happening in our lives via Facebook. So I feel like I've gone on the journey, especially with, you know, your nostalgia interviews over the last, you know, few years.
Yeah. So and for me, it's been amazing in that sense to catch up with people, see where people are. And in many cases, people are doing different things to what they were doing before. But in most cases, they're not at all. And that's the great thing. We're all on a journey. So it's like recognizably the same people, but we see people at different stages of that journey. And it's nice to regroup, catch up, and see what everybody's up to. So it's wonderful to have you here today. But do you want to say a bit more, Heidi, about your background? Because obviously you have an Edinburgh association, but you're from the US in the first place, but not necessarily Texas. Is that right?
Yes, I like to kind of describe myself as kind of, I was trained as a journalist who's kind of then morphed into a media studies scholar, but actually it academically gets trained as a theologian. So I did my PhD at the University of Edinburgh. So, you know, I've been working in interdisciplinary areas, you know, between religion, media, and culture for, you know, again, over about two or three decades in my work. And so it's, which is fun because I get to have conversations with people from many different disciplines kind of areas in that kind of intersection.
And in that sense, was your very first degree in something closer to journalism rather than in religion?
Yeah, my first was communications, and I focused on kind of professional and broadcast writing. So writing for, you know, I worked a little while as a radio journalist, and I was also as a newspaper journalist. And I thought actually I would go into journalism full time, but, you know, life had other paths for me.
Yeah, but did you find that in some ways the work that you're doing now is kind of not quite journalism, but you're doing the same, you're inquiring in the same kind of way, you're asking the same sort of questions, albeit through the lens of obviously religious studies. But do you kind of find that you're asking the same sort of questions? Is it a way of, have you found that you've been able to put your own imprint, if you like, your own signature on your career?
Yeah, I think, you know, training as a journalist was perfect for an academic that I didn't know at the time. You know, just learning how to, you know, kind of spontaneously ask questions, kind of looking at things from a different perspective, like trying to find that one kind of story that kind of tells, that proves the point, rather than kind of just, you know, using kind of sources and facts, but kind of trying to keep up one narrative. And I think that's really influenced kind of both how I do my research and how I write up my research, and just trying to kind of reveal what are these stories that are kind of in emerging, and how do these stories come together to tell a larger, you know, narrative about how religious communities are responding, or how culture is adapting or resisting certain trends within culture.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I'm just thinking that the work that you've done recently, and it must be the most current research. I mean, it normally takes years for a book to be published, you know, from its inception to its final publication. But we're in the midst of a global pandemic, and you've just had something published on the COVID-19 virus, and that just sounds extraordinary. Do you want to say a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I mean, I had an advantage this semester because I was on academic leave, because of kind of all of the center I was at was quickly closed down. So by the beginning of March, I found myself in this little tiny apartment with my husband in Germany, really not able to leave. And I ran out of yarn. One of my sabbatical goals was to learn how to knit, and I was learning how to knit, and I ran out of yarn, and there was nothing to do with my extra time. And so my husband said, "You need a new hobby." And so I kind of kid that, you know, taking up learning about how producing ebooks and e-publishing has been like my kind of new hobby that I took on.
Yeah.
But, you know, like most people around the middle of March, I remember tuning in around the 13th or 14th of the month. And usually I have, because of the friends I follow on Facebook, there may be about a half dozen worship services that come up, you know, over the course of a Sunday. But there was over 20 services that were streaming on that Sunday. And I was just amazed at kind of the different styles and the different perspectives. And just even some of the people I knew they had bad-like tendencies, or they were resistant to technology. But here, how did they end up online in just such a short amount of time? And so that's kind of where some of the questions that came from. It really was kind of inspired, you know, Born Digital project, because I wanted to see, you know, why were people making the choices that they were? How was it changing their perception of technology, especially if they were resistant before to technology? And just also to kind of ready to process what was happening, because I think, you know, a lot of people were really like, you know, wow, we were affecting not just that our research was being affected, how we did it, how we taught our classes, but also, you know, how do we process this information? This is a phenomenon, and this is affecting on a global level in a way we hadn't seen before. And also that it was affecting kind of just how we process, you know, what religion is, and how it adapts. So, you know, I found that this was a moment I felt like I really needed to capture and really needed to document. And luckily, I just had the time and space to be able to do that.
Yeah. And it sounds as well that the whole question about technology and communication is so very much of the moment, in the way that if, for example, the pandemic had happened, say, 25, 30 years ago when I was at university, I don't know how I would have been taught, because I had to learn very quickly how to deliver online seminars or webinars. But if I had been at university 25, 30 years ago, and we were all having to work from home, I don't know. I guess there could have been some form of correspondence. We could have been sent notes, but we wouldn't have been able to access any online sources. We wouldn't have been able to go to a library. And I don't really know how we could have continued with the degree. I can only imagine it would have to have been suspended for a period of time with all the cost implications for the university. So in that sense, it kind of feels that, well, obviously I never expected anything like this to happen in my lifetime. In a funny way, in happening, it's made us realise just how, wherever we are in the world, you're in Texas, I'm in Canterbury, it just kind of feels that somehow we are able to connect, and we have the means, if we really want to do something, if we want to communicate with each other, want to do to continue our educational journeys, we can do that. And in a way, if you'd said to me 6 months ago that we'd be where we are now, I would have said, oh my gosh, you know, inconceivable that I could do my job from outside my office, let alone, you know, continue to let students continue with their degree programs.
Yeah, so I've been studying for 25 years, how people, especially religious communities, use technology and how they adapt and adopt them. And so it was just like 6 months ago, and even in November, I was at different conferences talking with people in religious studies and theology about, religious innovation and technology, and just giving, pushback saying, hey, why should theology pay attention to media studies? What does it really have to tell us? And we're hearing these voices of the resistance in that, that's a different subject area, or that doesn't really affect religion. And then, 3 months later, they're seeing people blogging about technology and what they're having to look at, and like going, I think a lot of people had that wake-up call and had this kind of a first change of mindset. It's like, one of the research projects I'm working on right now is looking at how religion is represented through memes. And it was the reason I was in Germany to originally start out with. And there was a couple of memes that kind of were telling. One was it was a cartoon of a minister, and the Pope, and he says, remember what I said about the internet being from the devil? Scratch that. It's a gift from God. Yeah. And that's the kind of moment I think a lot of people had. It's like, wow, now that I first use it, actually it's a positive, could be seen as a positive thing, whether I could just have the problematic things of that content or the lack of control that people had about messages, I think, at the time.
Yeah. And I think there's a very fine line, isn't there, between adversity and opportunity, that nobody could possibly want what's happening to be happening, but at the same time it shows how resourceful, how creative we are. And what about if I'm allowed to ask, the findings of the research? I know you've got lots of different people contributing, but what would you say are the real standouts?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell just a little bit about the project. So this is actually my second ebook. So I did actually, the first ebook was trying to contact friends of mine on Facebook that were pastors and saying, how are you responding to the pandemic? How are you using or not using technology? And then contacting some of my friends that are researchers to say, okay, from your research, if you were going to talk to these pastors, what would you advise? So I'm trying to create this digital conversation. But I only kind of saw, I wanted to kind of spread that and look at more kind of comparative, especially with I've studied Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. There's similarities and differences in the response to technology. So I really wanted to have this interdisciplinary conversation. I called on several friends of mine, and I said, hey, why don't we, as a religious studies, scholars and faculty at my university, if I gather all your narratives, and half of them kind of personal narratives saying, this is my own spiritual journey and how my faith community has responded to the pandemic and what it's made me think about religion. And then the other half of essays were looking at graduate students and researchers saying, hey, this is how my study of religion has changed, or forced me to look at different questions or methods because of what's happening. So that was kind of what we're trying to create. And it was interesting in looking at kind of both the personal narratives as well as research kind of oriented narratives. There's several kind of themes that emerge, and at the end of the book, in the conclusion, we talk about eight of them. But I think they kind of fall into three categories. One is just this kind of aha moment about technology. A, this kind of discovering that even though they're that sometimes you can be ideologically opposed to something, but still forced into that culture. And, that kind of renegotiation, how it causes you not just to see the technology, but also the culture and especially a religious community or organization. So looking at, technology can be a helpmate was a clear finding. And also engaging with technology, they realize that, that But people always solve all the problems they thought. So for one example, you know, pastors, for the first ones, we'll really focus on, hey, I got to learn Zoom, I got to learn how to do a YouTube channel, and just get the service online. But then we realized that, you know, they provided this event for people to plug into, but it was really a passive event, and it really kind of brought the whole broadcast, or the audience is just kind of, you know, a passive consumer of media. And so they began to say, like, wow, just because I put it online doesn't mean I've created this interactive experience, because that's the whole buzzword. They think technology is interactive, and realizing you actually have to design that and put that into the space. So I think there has been a lot of kind of these aha moments about technology, how it affects us, and how you have to be reflective in your use of it. And I think the second big thing was just the debate, and this is the debate I've been having, I have part of for 25 years about, you know, is religion embodied? Can it be disembodied, or what, to what extent can it be mediated through another kind of form? You know, there's been, I think, a lot of the debates that have been happening, especially in the last month, where people are like, we got to get back to, you know, to church, we got to, you know, get back to the Eucharist, is because they have a theology of the body that's very centered on a physical gathering. And that, you know, the idea that if you can't gather in a physical place and in a physical moment, then the church really can't exist, which is a really interesting theological move. There's some truth in that, you know. There is an importance of the body, obviously, in, you know, a lot of theological ideas and doctrines. But at the same point, it's like, when did the worship become an event? When did religion become about the Sunday kind of gathering, that being the epitome of manifestation? So it raises a lot of interesting questions about, you know, to what extent is embodiment a central role in religion, especially in contemporary society? And also, to what extent is religion become event program oriented rather than community oriented? And so those are some of the findings we found, and they were consistent between, you know, the different religious perspectives that were written about in the book.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's a wonderful nexus, and I know from the work of yours that I've read and indeed use with my students, this whole interplay between online religion and religion online, and the way in which, as you say, the physical church and the online church can sometimes have a lot more in common than simply a one over the other. And the way in which, you know, there's, I think you use different categories, don't you? There's the notice board type approach to say that, you know, you can go online to find out what's happening in the physical church, but there can actually be online services and confessionals and all sorts of debates, which actually mean that we change and reclassify and recategorize the way that we, you know, we understand religion to take place. And it sounds like with the virus on at the moment, it seems that, and of course, in many cases, the physical churches are having to lock their doors. You know, Easter Sunday being a very classic case in point. The Archbishop of Canterbury was delivering the Sunday morning Easter communion service from the kitchen table, and obviously on his own with a laptop in front of him. So, you know, again, I mean, in a way, it must be a dream in a way for someone like you with the research you're doing, because you're kind of seeing the crystallization of the very sort of debates that you were, certainly when I knew you 10, 15 years ago, were very much in its sort of more embryonic form.
Yeah. I mean, what is interesting is like, you know, there's been certain debates that, you know, been 25 years ago, I remember they were raised when I was doing my proposal defense to my committee, and every time I would talk to people at, you know, at church saying, this is what I'm studying, they'd be like, you know, well, it's disembodied. If it's through mediation, it can't be religion. And I'm like, well, but what about, you know, the, you know, ideas of the body of Christ, which is this metaphor that doesn't physically exist, but we think of ourselves as connected to this global, you know, network or symbolic form. There's a lot of kind of language in religious traditions that kind of that really match this whole kind of network reality we live in. But like, they're kind of held onto these kind of more traditional notions of community as something that's embodied, is based on family ties and institutional ties, it's very structured. So it offers this really interesting kind of pushback and saying, like, it's causing people to try to think through this, but, you know, that the whole virtual communion versus embodied communion, that I've been in that debate for 25 years, and so this time around I let other people kind of, you know, find their perspectives, and I just actually read this time, so that was one of the debates I decided I'm not going to get into that one. I've done that before.
Yeah. But it comes to something when you feel that a research project is one that everybody is tuned into to some degree, this whole question about how we deal with the inner and the outer, religion out there, religion in here. You know, this in a way is something that has really affected people in their daily lives. I mean, some people, of course, have found lockdown to be particularly difficult precisely because the norms, the structures, the rhythms, even on a superficial level, although for many people, getting a coffee isn't superficial, but just the sort of things that we take for granted to start our day cannot be done in the same way. You know, sometimes if you're somebody who goes to work or goes to a cinema or goes to a coffee shop, you can't do any of those things, and they stop kind of overnight. So I think that it's, you know, the sort of work that you're doing is, I think, really foundational in terms of asking those questions about how we adapt, whether we can still almost keep that sense of authenticity, that sense of individuality. And of course, moreover, when we come out of lockdown, what sort of world are we going to be in? Are we just going to return to the world that we were in before March? Or are we going to start to practice things in a new, very different kind of way? Is this kind of, you know, a harbinger for, shall we say, for a completely different way of acting and embodying and going about our daily rhythms and routines?
Yeah. I mean, the things that this came out in one of my colleagues who's Jewish, when she was reflecting on, you know, what it was like to do media and Passover for the first time, as well as a friend of mine and a colleague at work who's a Muslim, and was thinking about, you know, how they were preparing for, you know, Ramadan, or, you know, how that was changing the preparations as well as the practices. But, you know, both of them, you know, kind of just described that, you know, both of these are religions of kind of pilgrimage. They're religions that have kind of been, you know, disconnected from their original space, by where many people live. And so they are, you know, religion is something that's always had to adapt to its time and culture. But what we've seen a lot during this season is this sort of kind of rigidity of like, no, if I have to change this, you know, if I can't be in the pew, if I can't, you know, be at the mosque, you know, then I can't actually be religious. And if you're preventing me, you know, the lockdown, I mean, that's an issue of religious freedom. And I got this religious freedom somehow was equated with physical gathering. So I'm not allowed to practice my religion if I can't physically gather. And then, you know, when you think about Islam, you think about Judaism and even Christianity as these kind of, you know, religions of pilgrimage, that doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, so when did we go from being having these very expecting flexibility and dynamism, saying, you know, religion is a static form that we've kind of put in this nice little box, and that's the only way it can be expressed.
And I'm just thinking, and also in terms of going back, so sort of changing the parameters here, I mean, obviously nostalgia is the underlying theme in the podcast, but for you, I mean, did you ever imagine that you'd be doing the kind of research that you're doing now when you were younger, when, of course, the career in journalism seemed to be beckoning? Could you ever have imagined that you'd be doing, you know, now what, or doing, you know, then what you're doing now?
Yeah, of course, like, when I started my career, the internet wasn't even a thing. And, you know, I remember, like, you know, the first time I really got online was when I moved to overseas to start my, it was originally a master's that turned into a PhD. And, you know, so this is, yeah, I was just so, you know, kind of amazed by, like, wow, I can talk to somebody on the other side of the world that we've just been able to transgress this 24/7 geographic divide that we have as people. You know, so, you know, that was a really radical thing. But I think in some ways, you know, the questions that I'm asking are similar questions that I was really interested in even when I was a journalist. I'm interested in the question of what is community? What is a religious community in its true sense? How does it practice? And how do people find life and connection through that kind of space? So, you know, I'm asking about a different technology, and, like, you know, and I'm asking about, you know, the internet and email. I'm asking about video games on my career, blogs, you know, apps, social media, and I'm asking the same questions about internet memes, but, like, the question of community and religious community and the issue of religious authority, how it changed, has been the constant, though the technology and the landscape has completely changed.
Yeah. And one thing that we do have in common is, of course, an interest in media. And one thing I always enjoy asking in the interviews is the sort of question that sometimes seems far more foundational than perhaps, you know, on the surface it appears to be, which is about things like, well, earliest memories, but also musical interests, or maybe filmic or TV interests, the sort of things from childhood that maybe you're still, to varying degrees, still interested in. You know, do you listen to the same music now that maybe you were listening to when you were growing up?
Well, I grew up as a twin, so I have a twin sister. But, you know, I remember it, growing up, you know, music was really important to my parents. My mom had read somewhere that by playing classical musicians, it would help, you know, brain activity or whatnot. So she played us a lot of Rachmaninoff and Bach. And in fact, there are certain sonatas that if I hear today, even quite on my my innate instinct is want to fall asleep, because that's what I'm going to do. Oh, it was bedtime. I have to go listen to the sonata. So it is really interesting how kind of how media kind of culture us, I mean, train us in certain kind of directions to kind of react in certain ways, to hold certain kind of memories. And I think, you know, all of us, you know, have, especially when it comes to media in the 21st century, have these moments that are powerful. I think one of the most memorable moments for me, it happened actually when I was, we call it, you know, junior high, or I was in the junior high school age group, but it was when the Space Shuttle Challenger blew up in the U.S., and it was significant because it was in the 80s, and they actually sent a teacher up, so a lot of schools had brought, like, wheels on these big televisions on these big carts, and, you know, like, we get to actually interact with something other than a book today in our future. That was exciting. So, you know, a lot of us were watching it kind of go up, and then, you know, we also watched it blow up at the same time. And this was, like, you know, a really kind of traumatic experience for a lot of people, just saying, this is live, we're actually watching this event. But it was also the day that my mom discovered CNN News. So CNN, your 24/7 news, was really new. It had been around for a couple of years. But I remember going home with my mom. You know, she hadn't been listening to the radio that day, so she didn't know this had happened. And I said, you know, this is what happened. It blew up. Okay, you know, this is how it's affecting, you know, and what people are saying. So she immediately went, stopped cooking dinner, went, turned on the TV, and she just happened to turn on CNN. And she sat down, and she sat there for 2 full hours because the news show was still going. And I'm like, Mom, it's never gonna you're just gonna have to walk away. She was an understand this concept of, like, wow, we had this 24 news source, but how, you know, her life had been bounded by, you know, morning news, the after news and nighttime news, and now that boundary had been transgressed. And how that kind of, I think, you know, the constant consumption of media is something that kind of changed from, you know, her generation into, you know, my generation, of your media being something that's a constant with us rather than just something, a moment with us.
No, that's right. And you mentioned Challenger, and I remember that, 1986. And it was shown on a programme called John Craven's News Round. It was a children's news programme, and I think it must have been about 5 o'clock British time in the afternoon. And we were watching this, and when it blew up, and we saw it on live TV, I think at first we must have thought that in some way it was meant to happen like that. There was no way we could imagine that what was, because, you know, it's not every day you see a space shuttle go up. And it took a while to sort of realise quite what the impact was, you know, what we had just seen. And in a way, you know, how traumatising it is to then see, you know, this, you know, when you consider, a bit like the film Contact, of course, I suppose, with Jodie Foster, when there's a very similar scene in there to what happened with Challenger. And in a way, of course, it completely changes the way of, you know, live communication, the way in which we understand the news media, the idea that sometimes there's a sense in which you're watching something or something is being reported on that has already happened, so you're going over past events. Look at news now, when it's all about, in many cases, speculation, when there are all sorts of things going on, whether in Britain about Brexit or, of course, the virus or various things that the government of the UK at the moment is embroiled in over one of its senior advisors. I'm sure you've heard all about that. And in a way, the news seems to be much about imagining what will happen tomorrow or next year as about what happened. So I think you're right. The change in the way that with 24-hour news, we're often looking forward to what will happen. The news is about to be made. The journalists, in a way, are flagging up particular stories. It's a very different landscape to what we grew up with in the 70s and 80s.
I remember, you know, after living for a decade in the UK, doing my master's and PhD, postdoc, and then coming back, and, you know, just watching how the media landscape had changed. And I think because I'd gotten conditioned from the BBC, you know, it was still about what had happened or what was going to happen, but it was more fact-based. And if it was going to be editorialized or kind of comment, opinion, it was definitely, you could definitely tell, like, this is the editorial moment, or this is the, you know, the kind of interview. I remember turning on Fox News within the first week of being back, and I actually laughed at it because they were speculating so much on some kind of political event. I go, this is just ridiculous. And I laughed and thought, oh, you know, I've been hearing from my friends back in the States that, you know, that there was, you know, John Stewart and Stephen Colbert, they had started this new genre of humor kind of news, and you know, using humor to kind of talk about the news events and but look, make it look like reporting. I assumed what I was watching on Fox News was that TV show. And then the person I remember who was sitting next to me saying, no, this is actually serious news. And I was like, oh my goodness, you know, we again, this moment that has occurred of like, how news has become about speculation. It's about opinion. It's not fact-worthy anymore. And I think that tells us that, you know, like a lot of what we see, you know, in the news and especially, it's all about what could happen. That's one of those, you know, 15 million scenarios that could happen. But where is the truth in that? You know, we do definitely live in this post-truth era because it's hard to start and find those facts in the midst of all the opinion that is kind of what I was trained would never have been allowed in the newspaper or, you know, broadcast, you know, at least on the top, under a news story or a news program.
Yeah, and did you find, when you came over to the UK, did you find the way that the news is disseminated and broadcast very different? The editorial decisions being made are very different to what you were used to. I mean, how did you feel that you made that transition? Because in America, I think that the broadsheets can sometimes be very good, very informative, very substantial. But I think that sometimes in America, some of the TV and radio programs with, you know, with adverts every few minutes, there's a sense of it's a very much a soundbite type culture, grab the audience while they're there. Very, very different, I think, from the UK. Did you notice that distinction?
Well, I think, you know, one thing I love about the UK is that you have so much diversity, whether it's in kind of culture or just in accents or in a small space. You know, we have that much diversity, but it's spread out a much larger area in the U.S. And so I think that's it. It seemed like people knew, like, okay, if you read The Guardian, this is probably political and, you know, a cultural kind of mindset. Oh, if you read The Independent, it's this. If you listen to BBC One or BBC Two. But the identification wasn't as strong where I grew up. So, you know, and also I left just as kind of we were getting these kind of rather local news sources, but national news sources, you know. So, you know, and if you listen to NBC versus CBS News, there wasn't really a sense of political identity. But I kind of saw that, like, you could, okay, if I want to get a diverse perspective, I'm going to read these two newspapers or this. So there's much more sense of a transparency of, you know, the opinion or perspective, as well as it was kind of framed to kind of say, you know, okay, this is opinion. It was going to, yeah, it was clear that it was opinion versus, you know, and this, or this is a feature which is expanding on facts, or this is a news item which is supposed to try to at least present two sides of the story. That's become, you know, much more mixed and much more convoluted, I think, in the American landscape. Yeah. And now I'm more aware, you know, because I've been back here for a while, but I think a lot of people don't realize that, you know, how much things are driven, especially in media, by who owns it and who pays for it. It's, you know, it's not the fourth estate. It's not this ambivalent or neutral body. It's really a gender-driven service. And I think, you know, some of the overly optimistic ideals of a young journalist, you know, that I was given, you know, from the Society of Professional Journalists, of, you know, that we aren't biased, that we present a full perspective. We don't, you know, you weren't, as a journalist, you weren't even supposed to register as a Republican or a Democrat. That wasn't the rule. That was the kind of unspoken truth that you remain neutral. And that is so not the truth nowadays, that, you know, people speak from a very blatant perspective. And I think, you know, it's problematic in many contexts.
And I remember watching the Warren Beatty film Bulworth, over 20 years ago now, and that really nailed it. And it seemed a really remarkably, actually quite left-wing, even Marxist kind of take. And I know that Warren Beatty himself was toying with the idea. Maybe it was for publicity, but he was toying with the idea of running for the White House. This would have been before George W. Bush was elected. So this would have been in the late 90s when he was thinking of entering the race. And I remember thinking at the time, it's very interesting because we don't have those same, we have those debates in the UK in terms of the Murdoch press, but the whole issue of, you know, objective news, certainly growing up, there was always that sense that there may be something different in the delivery style, but what you got was always informative, and, you know, there may be no such thing as objective broadcasting. But you always felt with the BBC that there was actually something in the news today over the Dominic Cummings saga about the BBC Two Newsnight programme yesterday breached editorial guidelines because it seemed to be pushing a particular line that was sort of anti-government. But it's, I think you're right, it's particularly in recent years, this notion of truth, this notion of what we expect our media outlets to do, the interplay between the politicians and the networks, it feels a very different sort of landscape. And I guess in a way, the sort of research that you're doing is able to encompass or be aware of those very quite, you know, certainly coming from a British perspective, you know, quite exotic and bewildering sort of perspective.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, you know, we talk about it, you know, at the postmodern turn and how, you know, the deaths of the men in area, there's no one overarching story that helps us explain anything. There's just multiple stories that are all competing for attention. And that's really the truth of what happened in news. You know, news had a very narrow definition when I was studying it and was first a journalist. You know, it covers the who, what, where, when, why, and how. Interpretation was not, you know, allowed, you know, in this front news page. But it's, you know, the whole idea, like, well, we don't want to tell this diverse story, and so in kind of adding more options of what is provided news or what is considered factual, you know, kind of muddied the waters. And, you know, I think, you know, the modernist and postmodernist trends, media literacy, digital literacy is so important because the thing that, you know, I realize that I take for granted because I've grown up in this transition. Some people don't, you know, they haven't had time, hard time just differentiating between what is a news story and what is an editorial piece on the news.
Absolutely. And we're starting to break up a little bit. So I'll just turn, Heidi, to some more, shall we say, philosophically based questions. Would you say, as you survey your whole life and career, would you say that your memories are predominantly positive ones?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I look back, you know, there's always those moments of challenges, especially in you know, in the teenage years and the adult years. But yeah, I mean, again, I feel blessed. I'm having a best friend ever since I was born, you know, and so I've had a great sense of support in my life, as well as, you know, a family that, you know, I think like all families, you know, you have your ups and downs, but overall they've been very supportive of me doing the kind of research I do that is really outside, you know, I push the boundaries of as far as theologically and politically where my background comes from, and they've been really willing to accept that even if they don't agree with all the standpoints.
Yeah, and you mentioned friendships, but do you feel that there's been any sort of departures in terms of the career and the interest that you followed compared to some of your friends from growing up? In other words, are you still in touch with people who you grew up with? And to what extent do you feel that they're doing things very, very different to what either you or they ever imagined they'd be doing?
Well, I mean, like there's a lot of people that, you know, like I was in the kind of 90s to the 2000s when I was overseas, I kind of lost connection with a lot of people. But through the advent of Facebook, you know, I'm back in touch with a lot of people from high school. You know, some people I was good friends with and others just weren't kind of loosely connected to because we all graduated during the same year. But I guess the two things as well is, you know, I grew up in a very small community. It's a strong tourist economy in Michigan, but also a lot of farming community. So we're kind of conserved in their values. And so it's funny, like when I'm in Texas, sometimes I feel conservative compared to their perspective. But I go back to my hometown and I'm a flaming liberal. Yeah. Yeah. In this political and cultural thing. And it's because none of those people have never left that county that we live in. It's a beautiful place, you know, and I love going back there myself to see the beach and see in the nature. But, you know, just how, you know, just kind of moving overseas and traveling a lot and just getting a higher education, it really does expand your perspective on the world. And I'm really glad for that. But like I said, it's funny, like it's one place I'm, you know, I'm considered really overly conservative. The other ones I'm overly liberal. And so I always feel like I never ideologically fit in one place, but that's kind of a fun place to be sometimes.
Absolutely, because I find sometimes when you're watching films, I mean, I see this because as somebody who's only been to America a few times in my life, but watching like those John Grisham novels, the Firm is a good example, the Tom Cruise film, you know, and the Boston versus he goes to, is it Tennessee, certainly one of the southern states, and you see that some of the things he took for granted in Boston or Harvard where he was did his law degree, in practicing the law. It's a very different kind of world, and it's fascinating to watch that from the outside. I think it's often interesting that you sometimes have a lot of, like, John Schlesinger, British directors who go to America and make films, and they seem to really capture something because of the outside kind of vision. You've probably had some of that as well, having lived and worked in both the UK and the US, and seen some of those sort of changes. I mean, politically, in that sense, when you're in Britain, do you feel that you're in a very different sort of space compared to how people perceive you in America, in Texas, for example?
Yeah, no, I mean, because I grew up in Michigan, which is kind of, it's a more Democratic oriented, but I grew up in a very conservative community, very much Republican kind of dominated. So moving to the UK was really an eye-opener, seeing like, wow, we can have social systems that are different than, you know, a capitalist system, and they actually be positive. Socialism does have its benefits, and, I would write these things to my friends back home, and we were like, that's sacrilege. But when I moved to Texas, I moved actually directly from Scotland to Texas, and I'd never been to Texas before except for like a stopover on a plane for like an hour. And they were really sneaky when I came for my job interview. They brought me in February, where it was a lovely 65 degrees outside and sunny. And so, of course, wow, great, this great university, beautiful environment, great resources. Of course, I'll take the job. The day I got off the plane to start that job, it was actually 105 degrees, and I'm like, oh no. Yeah. But the first 2 years I was in Texas, I went through reverse culture shock, and it was like, it wasn't shock so much. I never really knew. And I guess being shocked because I've been outside the U.S. I was overseas when 9/11 happened, and there was a huge cultural change and kind of attitudinal change in America, from a sense of kind of being what is this new fear, and also there was new anger because we had to be fearful or had to be kind of seen as we weren't infallible anymore. Dealing with that, but just dealing with cultural values. I mean, the churches were different, the food was different, the politics was different, and I I kept thinking, am I going through American culture shock or Texas culture shock? And the answer was yes to both. Yeah. After being away for a decade. Yeah.
But I guess, do you find that, as I do often, because although I'm obviously not in Wales anymore, because obviously I was there for many years and from Wales, I'm still able to capture with a lot of the radio programs, the news, obviously, from where I'm from. But I guess in your case, do you kind of feel that you've still got a great sort of passion for all things Edinburgh related? Do you sort of still listen to some of the music that you grew up with, while you were studying over there? I mean, do you have this sort of very sort of eclectic interest in films, video games, music, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I still think that Edinburgh is the most beautiful city in the world on a sunny day. Yeah. It's still my favorite place to be. I just love all the cosmopolitanism shoved into a very small space, and without the kind of craziness you get of a Glasgow or Manchester or London. I'm really fond of that. And the one thing, I've noticed that because I missed a whole decade of American popular culture, I forget that, I talk about Robbie Williams and none of my students in America know who he is. I talk about, the popular bands and the things that I got exposed to during the 90s to the 2000s when I was in the UK, and realizing that there's my kind of identity and my kind of understanding of culture has changed. It's been great because in some classes, when I talk to teach my global media class, we always talk about Eurovision. I can show how it kind of expresses certain things about globalization, and we always watch the latest videos, and that's fun. But I've also had students critique my class saying she talks too much about Europe in her classes. And I think it's because so many formative things happened about my kind of spiritual as well as political identity while I was in the UK, that I am really kind of been impacted by that. And sometimes I don't realize the words I use, the examples I use, are kind of actually really of a different culture, and I forget that they need some more contextualization or interpretation for an American audience that has a very kind of select window, just like people in Europe have a very select window.
Yeah, but I do find as well, though, that sometimes if I'm delivering the same lecture material, that I may have, you know, taught a few years ago, that sometimes I have to change the examples, because whereas, you know, 10, 15 years ago, my students would have seen The Shawshank Redemption or Groundhog Day, I find now when I use these as examples, increasingly they're less familiar with them. And I remember one occasion I was teaching a course on religion and film. We were looking at biblical epics, and the students had not, well, they may have heard of, maybe even seen in some cases, The Life of Brian, but they didn't know The Greatest Story Ever Told, King of Kings, Last Temptation of Christ. And I thought, well, I've got the students for 2 hours. You know, they're not aware of any of the examples I'm going to give. But they had all seen Bohemian Rhapsody at the cinema that weekend, not all of them, but, you know, some of them had seen it. And suddenly I was then able to use that as a way in terms of the biopic, hagiography, the way in which you look back on somebody's life from after the event and sort of put people on pedestals and reinterpret what they did. And somehow then, for the whole course, we were looking at each individual Jesus film through the lens of Freddie Mercury. I hadn't planned to do that, but it meant that the students were hooked. And somehow it all felt that I was thinking on the spot. I wasn't just giving a lecture that I prepared many, you know, and given many times before. So I think that's interesting. So it's very interesting, but at least in that sense, you may be giving lots of European examples, but maybe in the future, those students will look back and think, actually, you know, you gave them a slice of something which only you could have given. And in that sense, just as no doubt you had many teachers who inspired you for all their very quirks and idiosyncrasies, in the same way you're probably doing something which, in many respects, you know, no one else is going to be able to offer them. So in that sense, it's probably a wonderful, very eclectic, very global education that you're able to administer and deliver.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, just like most people who teach, you know, it's that sad day when, like you said, you have to let go of your favorite movie, your favorite musician example that, you know, that you've used for years. I teach a course on meaning religion, and I remember the day that I realized I could no longer use the Matrix trilogy as kind of my core. I taught this one session on the theology over popcorn, and I love to talk about the symbolism because it was, you know, created to be this multi-faith, kind of multi-philosophical perspective molded into one kind of movie narrative. But realizing that, you know, most of them, either if they had heard of it, but they hadn't seen it, and so they didn't get all the references, they didn't understand it. So now I show bits of The Matrix, you know, for a little bit, but, you know, the fact that As it were, that lecture is on the shelf for now. It makes me sad sometimes.
Oh,
like, I miss
well,
it.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, I've only got one more question to ask you, but I have to just mention this, that they showed, I think it was the 20th anniversary showing of The Matrix at one of the cinemas, one of the multiplexes I go to in Kent last year. And then she was a young woman. The girl who took my ticket as I was going in said, because she said, I haven't seen this film before. And then she said, do you know what? And I said, oh, I saw it in, what was it, June 1999. Actually, I saw it the week before my PhD viva. And she said she wasn't even born then. I think she was either born, you know, later that year or the following year. And I thought, you know, I wish I'd stayed home that evening, because and the film actually looks surprisingly analog, actually, as well, with lots of it's all very hard copy. Everything is on drives, everything is on portals, you know. And I, at the time, it seemed so futuristic. So, you know, when The Matrix starts to look old, that you know that, you know, you've really crossed that line into severe middle age. But I've got one more question for you, Heidi. Would you say that you're a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I'm a looking forward person that is always looking back for context. Yeah. I mean, it's part of us as academics, we have to kind of see, you know, where are things going, what's the next trend. And that's, you know, the journalist I was trying to tell the story right now because you want to see where the story is going. So I'm definitely informed by that. But, you know, I'm a firm believer, and on the National Archives in the U.S., it says, has something to the effect of a quote, like, you know, the past is prologue, study the past. And the idea is that if we don't remember the past, we don't remember the story we came from or the context that have informed us, then we're just going to repeat the same things. You know, there's so many stories happening right now about how the 1918 pandemic in the U.S. and how people reacted. And we're basically replicating the same thing all over again. And we're seeing the same spikes and peaks and cycles. And it's like, in 100 years, we haven't learned anything. The people that graduated in, you know, 1918 in high school, in high school, they went through the same challenges. You can see their pictures with the mask on, but yet we're still making the same mistakes. And I firmly believe we have to have one hand in the past as we're pushing toward the future.
Yeah. That's a perfect answer. And Heidi, thank you ever so much for being my guest this week.
Thank you, Adam. I apologize for the nice background of hail and storm they had. Maybe they had a good drama in certain parts of the movie, though.
They are Texas noir. There, that's what it says.